I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. While hospital staffs are on the front lines dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, there's another public health crisis that has not gone away. Gun violence. That's certainly true here in Philadelphia, where there were 120 shootings in March and where the number of homicide victims is up 15% compared to this time last year, according to the police department. Our guest, Dr. Eleanor Kaufman, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that caught our attention with this headline, "Please stop shooting. We need the beds." It was about her work in a hospital trauma center in Philadelphia with gunshot victims competing for space and services with COVID-19 patients in the ICU. Dr. Kaufman is a fellow in trauma and surgical care at the University of Pennsylvania, where she researches trauma outcomes and injury prevention. And Dr. Kaufman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Is there a connection between the pandemic and gun violence? Do we know?
There's a lot that we don't know, of course, about what's going to happen with this pandemic and how it's going to affect the rest of our lives and the rest of our healthcare. The connection that we see right now is just an overlap and in some cases a competition or a risk of competitions for resources and space in our healthcare system. But there's also reason to be concerned that aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic are actually going to worsen the problems that we already have with gun violence.
I'm curious about just the number of patients that come to the ER or come to where you work at the University of Pennsylvania. Are you seeing COVID-19 patients, in a sense, competing for services and for technology compared to gunshot victims?
So I would say that we are lucky in that our hospital has had both the wherewithal and to some extent the time to prepare thoughtfully for what's going on. And so as, you know, we've expanded the care of COVID-19 patients sort of unit by unit across the hospital, we haven't been in a dire situation where we've had to deny one patient something to give it to somebody else. We're not at that point. I hope we never will be. But certainly, you know, every time that severely injured patient comes into our emergency department, just by our routine, in normal situations, we put on a gown and a mask and a hat and gloves, personal protective equipment to prepare to care for that patient. Never in a million years would I have expected to be saving those masks to reuse again the next time. And, you know, that's what we're looking at now.
Absolutely. I'm sure it is. And are you saving those masks just because looking into the future, you're not sure you're going to have enough to deal with patients?
Yeah, that's right. We haven't run out. We're in a lucky situation so far, but we don't know what's going to happen next. So we're being very cautious in terms of conserving equipment.
I'm thinking about families and friends of gun shooting victims and the kind of care that you need to give them when you have to keep a distance, when you can't hug them or touch them. How has that changed the delivery of care that you've been doing?
Oh, it's hard for us, but it's so, so hard for patients, and it's so hard for families. You know, in the best of circumstances, having a serious injury, I mean, or any medical illness that's so severe that you need to be in intensive care, you know, is terrifying for the patient and for the family. And we do our best to explain everything and to keep patients and families up to date. But we don't have very many comforts that we can offer. In normal situations, I think the main comfort that I have to offer to families is to be able to say, well, I know this is scary, I know this is overwhelming, but you can be with your loved one whenever you can. You can always be in the room. We'll always be here to update you in person. And, you know, some of those very human aspects of care are the things that we're having to put aside for right now. And it's absolutely appropriate and needed right now, but it's hard on families, it's hard on patients, and it's really sad.
Yeah, I mean, there's no substitute for that person-to-person contact. Do the families understand what it is that we are all dealing with and knowing that they just have to keep a distance from their loved one?
I think for the most part, people understand. That doesn't make it easy, but
no.
You know, one of the, you know, sort of ironies of this situation is how clear it makes our interdependence. And in many ways, we've seen our community around the country, around the city, and you know, here in Philadelphia, coming together, you know, while staying apart, but right. people understand.
How are things going for the staff, yourself and others who are essentially on the front lines of this pandemic?
I think, you know, it's certainly a stressful time and a scary time. I think we've really come together as a mm-hmm. as a community, and the larger community has in many ways come together to support us. So we are holding it together.
As we know, Philadelphia and other urban areas have had a longstanding problem of gun violence. I'm curious, though, with all these stay-at-home orders, and not everyone is, of course, abiding by those orders, why we are still seeing so much gun violence. Can you help us understand that?
I can try. And we don't know for sure what's going to happen, but certainly it doesn't seem like yet we've seen any decrease in gun violence or injury. Unfortunately, yeah. there are reasons to believe it may actually increase. You know, I think it makes most sense if we look at the underlying forces that lead to gun violence, which are longstanding social inequity, structural violence, and systemic racism that have shaped the limited opportunities that people have in a city like Philadelphia and in our area. None of those are going away, and the economic impacts of this COVID-19 pandemic are going to hit the most vulnerable in our society the hardest, unfortunately. The other thing, there's a couple other things that I think about in terms of gun violence, but in terms of community gun violence, one of the gun violence prevention strategies that we believe is most effective is this concept of busy streets, and that the yeah. more people are out and about in their neighborhoods, the more positive activity, the more community connection that we have in our neighborhoods, the better, for so many reasons, including violence prevention. That's obviously not something that we're doing right now.
Well, in fact, we're obviously told to stay home. So you're saying empty streets can actually lead to more gun violence?
I think so.
Which seems counterintuitive, because you figure if there are not a lot of people on the street, I mean, it does raise questions about who is there. But I guess the effect of a crowd on trying to sort of mitigate some of these problems.
Right. And just we spoke a second ago about the stress that healthcare workers are feeling, but I think that we cannot underestimate the stress that we're all feeling in society, and particularly people whose existence is already stressful at baseline, people with few resources, people with no cushion to rely on in a time like this. That level of stress is absolutely puts us at risk for increased violence.
I'm also thinking, and we know that the domestic violence and even suicide can be a very serious gun-related problem. I think half of gun deaths are related to suicide, or perhaps even shootings related to suicide. Are we seeing that, and can we expect an uptick in that?
Yeah, I don't think we know for sure yet what the effect will be, but it's definitely something I'm worried about. So 60% of gun deaths are suicide, and if you look at it the other way around, half of all suicides are committed with guns. The reason that is that many more people attempt suicide, but mm-hmm. guns are very lethal. So if a person attempts suicide with a gun, they're likely to die. They're 90% chance of dying, which means that they don't get that second chance to get that mental health treatment that might save their lives. Because we know if someone survives a suicide attempt, most people don't go on to die of suicide later. Some do, of course, but most don't. So that second chance is really valuable. And unfortunately, guns usually don't allow that second chance. So yes, absolutely. If we think of people being more isolated, people being under stress, people purchasing firearms that they might not have had in the home before, all of these things are risk factors for increased suicide. I don't think we have the data to say for sure, but it's definitely a fear.
Sure, something to keep an eye on. I mean, until Governor Wolf shut down gun shops, there were pictures of long lines of people waiting to buy guns. And I'm not saying that all those people are going to commit some kind of crime or self-injury, but it certainly was confounding and worrying to see.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I know that many people believe and hope that owning a gun, having a gun in the home will make them safer, but we have a lot of data to tell us that having a gun in the home actually puts people at increased risk of homicide and of suicide, as well as, you know, of accidental injury, the kind of thing that can happen, especially now with kids cooped up at home. A new weapon that looks like a new toy is another thing that I think is kind of scary.
Oh, thinking about, of course, children, right?
Right.
Have you seen, and I'm just curious, in the last, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, have you seen children being brought to the ER, for instance?
So I, just specifically because of where I work, the trauma that we see is at Penn Presbyterian Medical Center. So we see teenagers and right. we see adults, but the children in our city go elsewhere.
Right. Obviously, going to Children's Hospital being one of the most obvious places to go.
Right. Yeah.
So what do you, as we all try to figure out how to make it through this pandemic, we're sort of talking about an epidemic, and gun violence has been described as a public health crisis, an epidemic on top of a pandemic. What do you hope we can do and learn from this crisis?
Well, first of all, I hope that we get through it yes. with as many of us here and intact as possible. And I do hope that we learn or are reminded of how interconnected we are as a community, as a society. And unfortunately, I think this may serve as a major wake-up call for our society and people who have not been paying attention to the way that our healthcare system and our public health system have been under-resourced and neglected. I think if we can use our public health wherewithal and resources to get us through this pandemic, there's so much else that needs to be done in our society with those same techniques and strategies. I think we know a lot of what we need to do to decrease gun violence, and if we have the resources and wherewithal to do it, we can.
Right. I mean, what is that phrase about don't let an emergency or a crisis go to waste? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. I mean, I don't want to sound in any way opportunistic, but I do think that the current crisis is putting a lot of people at risk, both directly from COVID-19 and indirectly from the other health consequences of delayed care and from the economic and social consequences. But I think it's also a reminder of what we can do when we come together.
In fact, we're going to pick up on that with our two guests who will be joining us for the rest of the hour. Dr. Eleanor Kaufman, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. She's a fellow in trauma and surgical care at the University of Pennsylvania, researches trauma outcomes and injury prevention. And after this very short break, we'll be talking about the connection between poverty and the pandemic. And we've got two guests who'll be joining us in just a few moments. So do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The coronavirus has shed light on some deep and systemic problems in this country, including economic inequality. People with low incomes are more likely to have chronic illnesses, which puts them at greater risk for contracting the disease and greater risk from dying from COVID-19. Many with low-income jobs work in industries that put them in direct contact with the public, increasing their chances for getting sick. Many of those jobs do not offer sick days or have shut their doors because of stay-at-home orders, leaving their staff wondering and worrying about how to pay the bills. Everyone is feeling stressed because of the pandemic, but if you add up all the unique pressures on people with low wages, things can get overwhelming very fast. Today on Radio Times, poverty and the pandemic. Joining us is Roy Wade. He's an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He works at Cobbs Creek Primary Care in West Philadelphia, where his research focuses on the intersection between childhood poverty, adversity, and well-being. Dr. Wade, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Ana Diaz-Ruz, and she's Dean and Distinguished University Professor of Epidemiology in the Dornsife School of Public Health at Drexel University. She's also trained as a pediatrician. And Dr. Ruz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Glad to be joining.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, you can join our conversation, Radio Times, at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page to join our conversation. Dr. Ruz, let me begin with you. And Philadelphia is the poorest large city in the country. Do you expect a disproportionate amount of coronavirus cases because of that?
Well, I think what we are already starting to see and will see even more clearly as the pandemic advances and as we have more data, is that coronavirus, both the rate of new cases as well as the severity of disease, as you indicated in your introduction, as well as the likelihood of dying from the disease, is going to cluster in lower-income neighborhoods, which are often also predominantly African-American neighborhoods, Latino neighborhoods, immigrant neighborhoods. So there's a lot of evidence from prior public health research and just from our understanding of how these diseases evolve that suggests that that is going to be the case. We're already starting to see that in data from several cities. Of course, there are many reasons why why this happens. One is simply that people in living in lower income neighborhoods are just going to be more likely to be exposed to the virus in the long run as a result of crowding conditions, their inability to fully implement social distancing, just as a function of the jobs that they have, as you indicated. There's data coming out that suggests that social distancing is clearly patterned by neighborhood income. And also there's, research, very elegant research actually showing that psychosocial stress that's often associated with poverty makes people more likely to develop the disease when they are exposed to a virus. So although sometimes, these diseases start out with a very different social distribution. For example, it's very possible, although, the data is not great, but it's very possible that COVID-19 started out in higher income areas because of its link to international travel. Right. We are rapidly seeing a shift in that distribution to where it's going to cluster in terms of incidence, severity, and unfortunately probably also mortality in lower income populations. So yes, this obviously has implications for our city.
Sure, and I want to pick up on that. But Dr. Wade, let me get you in on the conversation. And let's talk specifically about children. As we know in Philadelphia, as in most parts of the country, children are home. They're not in school. What do you see as the stresses that are unique to children and perhaps even unique to children who live in low-income families?
Well, I think there are a number of stresses that are unique to children in low-income families. You can take pretty much any outcome that you look at, and unfortunately, children who are living in under-resourced or economically distressed communities are going to experience disparities in that, and those disparities are going to be magnified as a result of this COVID-19 pandemic. Just take the child welfare system, for example. Children who live in economically distressed communities are unfortunately more likely to be involved in the child welfare system. Currently, mm-hmm. in Philadelphia, there's more than 4,500 children in the child welfare system alone, and social distancing policies are limiting the ability of caseworkers to come out and visit. They're limiting parent parental visitation within the child welfare system. The family court system remains closed and impacting hearings and the child welfare process, which may limit reunification of biological parents. That in itself, is a disparity alone that's born, unfortunately, by kids who are living in poverty.
Do children experience stress differently from adults?
I wouldn't necessarily say they experience stress differently from the adults. I think that the stress can impact them in different ways. Take, for example, kids who are between the ages of 0 and 6. Mm-hmm. What we know as pediatricians, and particularly in terms of their development, is that they are undergoing periods of rapid brain development. And the stress that they experience as a result of that can alter the way their brain develops, highlighting areas that govern the stress response and sort of enhancing or increasing those areas and becoming toxic for areas that govern their cognitive function and social emotional skills, which can then lead to over time, impairments in their development, increases in the risk for behavioral problems, learning problems, and cognitive problems later in life. And we know from prior studies looking at the impact of toxic stress that those experiences then translate into mm-hmm. adolescence and adulthood in terms of mental health and physical health problems.
Let me pick up on that and go back to you, Dr. Wu, and thinking about, I know you're a pediatrician, but thinking about adults and especially low-income adults at risk for things like chronic diseases, diabetes, asthma, stroke, heart disease. With this COVID-19 and the kind of stresses of chronic diseases, does that make them more susceptible to this particular virus?
Yes, this is a very, very important aspect because, as we know, and one of the sort of tricky things about this virus is that although a large proportion of cases are mild symptoms or even asymptomatic, the disease is particularly severe and even deadly in people who have underlying chronic conditions. And we know from decades of public health research that conditions like respiratory disease, cardiovascular disease, diabetes are very, very strongly patterned. So they're much more, significantly more prevalent in lower income populations and, in fact, cluster in low income neighborhoods, African American neighborhoods as well. People with those conditions get the disease, which they will likely be more exposed to for the reasons that we were talking about earlier, they are going to have more severe disease. So it's not just the rate of infection, but the severity of the disease and the likelihood of dying from it, which is going to be magnified by the differences in the prevalence of these conditions across neighborhoods. And that's very important because that's one of the most important drivers of the severity of the disease. And it may also, be magnified by issues related to access to care as well.
I was thinking about that. Yes, the fact that in fact, I was reading a Gallup poll reporting before the pandemic, something like 25% of people deferred getting health care because they could not afford it. And people with low incomes, I'm assuming that's even more dire than that, Dr. Wu.
Yeah, this has been, demonstrated, as you noted, that certainly having health insurance affects people's ability to have their condition, their chronic disease conditions under control. And I think, another aspect of this pandemic is that that it's also because of the social distancing measures that we're implementing and also because of the very understandable reactions of the healthcare system to postpone things that are not COVID-19 related or not urgent.
Right.
It's possible that many, many people with chronic conditions or other health conditions are having to defer care. And that's another way in which, this pandemic may enhance social inequalities in health.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Dr. Ana Diaz-Ruiz. She's a pediatrician, also dean and distinguished university professor of epidemiology at the Dornsteif School of Public Health at Drexel University. Also with us, pediatrician Dr. Roy Wade. He's an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania and a pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And he works at Cobbs Creek Primary Care in West Philadelphia, dealing with patients there. And we are talking about the impact of the pandemic on people with low incomes, on people with less access to the kind of supports and care that I think a lot of middle-class people have. And we want to have you join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, and we will work to get you into our conversation. Dr. Wade, how are you staying in touch with your patients in West Philadelphia?
So currently, I haven't been seeing patients as frequently at Cobbs Creek, but I have been connected to the practice, and we've done a number of different measures to try to improve access to care and respond to this, you know, current pandemic. I think one of the things that all the practices in the city have done is to split up into teams. One team that does telehealth medicine, and then the other team that's on site to provide care and try to respond to patients who have concerns for exposure to the coronavirus and may want testing or require additional services.
Let me go back to you, Dr. Ruin. I know that someone at Drexel University, Usama Bilal, did a study that Philadelphians in high-income neighborhoods are more likely to be tested for coronavirus than those residents living in low-income neighborhoods. And I think it was six times more likely. What does that tell us?
Well, I think, the differences in access to testing, you know, could suggest that the differences in the incidence of disease may be even larger than what they appear to be, because if there are, you know, if higher income neighborhoods are accessing more testing, we may be detecting more cases there, and we may be underestimating the cases in lower income neighborhoods. It's hard to tell at this point. I think we still need to see more data to be able to understand how big of an, you know, what the size of the inequalities and the incidence of disease are. But certainly, you know, the limited access to testing in general has been a major, major factor that just makes it really difficult for us to characterize the population distribution of this disease. But I think Usama Bilal's analysis suggests that the differences in access to testing may be impacting the number of cases that we're detecting. Obviously.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, I think the thing that's really sort of driving this crisis, this public health crisis, is we don't have enough tests to know who has the virus or who had the virus.
Right. Yeah, this is a major challenge. In some ways, we're sort of running blind because we just don't have the data that we would need to fully characterize what's going on. I mean, I think we're doing the right thing. We're implementing these social distancing measures. But I think as we have more information, we'll be able to understand a bit better what's really going on. You know, how many people are really infected? How is this distributed across the population? So it's a challenge.
Yeah. Dr. Wade, I'm thinking about the fact that there's so many children in this country now who are not going to schools. Now, certainly in Philadelphia, there are places where families and people can pick up food in order to be able to feed children. But without the kind of access that teachers have to young children, does that put pediatricians and others like yourself at a disadvantage?
Well, I think that it is a challenge for families, and I think it's a huge and major concern moving forward. One of the reasons I think that it's so important, particularly for young kids, is that we know that as I was saying before, that they're undergoing this period of rapid brain development.
Yeah.
And kids learn through play and social interaction with their same age peers, which often occurs in school settings. And so not having those opportunities to really engage with their peers in that way and to play with their same age peers, I think, can have longstanding ramifications. There was a study that looked at some of the ramifications of not being in school for an extended period of time following the Hurricane Katrina. And as you might know, the public schools were closed for the entire fall.
That's
in that
right.
2005 year. One study out of Tulane showed that it took, at least in terms of testing scores, it took up to two full school years for students to actually recover that learning. And the negative impact was largely borne by children of color and children who lived in low-income settings. And so it's a really concerning issue that we need to be addressing. I think that the school system, Philadelphia school system, has done tremendous work in terms of trying to continue to engage kids and providing kids with learning plans. And you know, my child is in the Philadelphia school district and making Chromebooks available for kids who don't have access to Chromebooks to laptops to be able to do virtual engagement with their peers, mm-hmm. virtual engagement with their teachers, and online learning.
But nothing really replaces, it seems to me, that human-to-human, that person-to-person, face-to-face contact that children really depend on.
Yeah, I think it's important, and it's what they need and strive. And you know, if this crisis continues, or as this crisis continues, I think that's the challenge for some of our educational leaders, is to think about how can we work to use our online tools to try to replace that or support parents in creating those opportunities. I think one of the challenges that parents face is that not only are schools closed, but they've been encouraged not to engage other families in playgroups, which is another way that kids have this opportunity to learn and develop those social interaction skills. And, you know, as this crisis continues, we have to think about ways we can allow those opportunities to occur without magnifying our risk for continuing the pandemic.
Well, let's take another break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about the pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic, its impact on a city like Philadelphia. It is the poorest large city in the country, and we are talking specifically about vulnerable parts of the population, children and teenagers, adults of low income who are trying to survive some of these stay-at-home orders and try to figure out how to support their families. And Roy Wade is a pediatrician at the University of Pennsylvania. Ana Diaz-Rue is a pediatrician as well, and she's also at Drexel University. And we want to hear from you, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Mosco.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, talking with two pediatricians, Drs. Roy Wade and Ana Diaz-Rue. Ana Diaz-Rue is Dean and Distinguished University Professor of Epidemiology at Drexel University. Roy Wade is an Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania, a pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also works as a pediatrician at Cobbs Creek Primary Care in West Philadelphia. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Dr. Rue, let me read what Steve emailed, saying, what about the hundreds of addicts in Kensington not practicing any precautions and the police not leading to and the police not policing leading to gun violence? He's concerned about, and this has been a part of the city that's really been hit hard by another epidemic having to do with opioids. But how do we deal with something like that?
Well, I think one very important aspect is that this pandemic is basically being overlaid on all these existing other epidemics and health problems that we have, and certainly the the opioid crisis is one of them, and so it will interact with it, and in many ways potentially reinforce what's already happening. I suspect we're likely to see eventually more cases among homeless people, among people in the street. And I think one of the aspects of this pandemic more generally, and I think this builds on something Dr. Wade was saying, is that it's making visible, more visible, and in many cases magnifying all the existing health and social problems that we have, because, for example, as social distancing, as Dr. Wade was saying, is affecting children, particularly children in poverty, who aren't able to go to school or aren't able to connect to school remotely. It's also has major implications for mental health, potentially, of adults who have to stay home, particularly vulnerable adults, people who get unemployed, lose their jobs. All those things in the short term have major health implications. So it's just making visible these other problems that we already have and making them potentially worse. So I think it's, in some ways, it's a call to action, to see how can we be better prepared to first of all, address these problems that we have, but also to minimize the impact of things like this in the future, which are going to be very, very strongly linked to social conditions.
You know, Dr. Wade, I was thinking about children and their social needs as they grow and develop. And as you described, certainly with the pandemic where people are told to stay home, children can't go to playgrounds. Is there another way to support that kind of emotional development that can be done in some kind of long distance kind of way, or can be done in a way that can help a child who feels so isolated and perhaps alone in the world?
I think certainly so. I have seen it in the case of my own family. I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, and my 7-year-old is in first grade, and we have a wonderful teacher, Ms. Schechter. Shout out to Ms. Schechter at CW Henry, who has scheduled 3 p.m. circle times with the kids. It's not mandated by the school. She just does it. As part of that practice, she had a colleague come on and teach our kids mindfulness practices to help deal with the stress of this current pandemic and having to be at home and not be able to engage with their peers. And then she's done things like have parents read stories and then have check-ins where the kids can have this opportunity to talk about their emotions and feelings. But I think one thing I want to highlight is that even in that, the disparities for low-income families will persist because, my kids have the fortune of having two engaged parents who have the time and have the wherewithal to help support them in that process. But a lot of the families that we're talking about, as was highlighted before, their families may not have access to internet services or might not have a laptop or computer to engage. There also may be issues with their job that require them to work during that time period. And a lot of the training that we get are around things that we can do as parents to help support our kids through this process. The other point I think needs to be highlighted is that, period of social distancing can increase toxic stress for kids, particularly toxic stress for kids who are living in poverty, because parents may be stressed out and may not be able to provide the nurturing and support that they need because of issues with their job or economic issues. Or we know that, unfortunately, as I was saying before, kids who live under economically distressed conditions are unfortunately more likely to be exposed to things like maltreatment and various toxic conditions as a result of the stress of poverty.
Well,
so that's something we have. Sorry, go ahead.
No. Finish your thought. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
I think that's something we have to think about in terms of how are we, you know, providing that support. What are some of the typical ways in terms of home visiting programs that we've used to try to address these issues, and how can we sort of double down on those ways to help parents and families who are living under these conditions?
And that's why I was thinking about teachers can sometimes see things with a child that doesn't get recognized by somebody else. And if they're not going to school, then the teacher might not be tuned into what might be happening at home.
And let's take that one step further. They're an array of different adults who engage kids on a normal daily basis that have that opportunity to identify these issues. And none of these adults, unfortunately, because of our social distancing policies, are able to engage kids in that way. So we're thinking not only about teachers, but we're thinking about coaches and clergy and
Even a crossing guard or something
right,
like that.
Exactly. And so it's a huge challenge for us in terms of how do we continue, particularly if this crisis goes on for much longer, you know, how can we develop those systems in place where we can have check-ins with kids and families to identify families who are experiencing large amounts of stress that place kids at risk.
Dr. Wu, here's an email from Aria. She says, how does isolation from peers affect a 2.5-year-old who used to be in daycare with 5 other children? And I think, you know, we could probably extrapolate that to other children who just have lost this kind of way of life that's so central to childhood.
Well, I'm sure there are many ways, large and small. We know certainly that social isolation has and loneliness certainly among adults has implications for health, and people who are isolated or report feeling lonely tend to have worse health outcomes and potentially also be more vulnerable to infectious diseases. I'm not sure how much of that work has been documented in children. Perhaps Dr. Wade can comment, but I suspect there are also many ways in which being isolated from others affects children's psychological well-being.
You want to answer that, Dr. Wade?
Absolutely. We know that children are dramatically impacted by social isolation. As I was saying before, children are social beings, and particularly at younger ages, the primary way they learn is through social interaction with same-age peers. And this places them at large risk for impairment in brain development and magnification of developmental problems and behavioral problems, particularly for kids who are living in economically distressed conditions.
Yeah, that's very worrisome. Dr. Wu, here's a more broad-based public health question about having to do with enforcement. And as we know, some people are abiding by these guidelines, other people are not. And by not abiding by them, you could be putting both yourself and others at risk. Is there, besides mandating this, do we need to police it better so that people are essentially forced to stay home?
Yeah, well, that's a complicated question. I mean, yeah. I think it's certainly true that that not engaging in social isolation, even if you're young and healthy, is not a good thing in the context of a pandemic and a virus like this, because you may become infected without knowing it, be asymptomatic, feel perfectly fine, but then go on to transmit to other people who will be very much affected by the disease. So, you know, young people who are out in the street and feel they're invulnerable, and it's true that the rates of severe disease are lower, although, young people do get severe disease as well. That's important
sure.
to remember. But in addition, the biggest danger is that they will then go home and transmit it to others who are much greater risk of very severe disease and even death. So, I think to look on the positive side, I think it's quite remarkable that society, not just in the United States, but all over the world, people are engaging in social distancing. Certainly there are, I think, areas where we can improve, and I think the city may have to think about whether there are additional ways they need to enforce social distancing. But I think to look at the positive side, it's quite remarkable mm-hmm. that people have come together and sort of collectively made a decision to embrace social distancing. I think you know, this is one of the also really interesting things about this pandemic in some ways, and, you know, to try to find a silver lining in it, that, you know, we've seen as a, you know, as a society, everything that we can do together, and, you know, it raises important questions about, you know, what if we had, you know, better unemployment benefits? What if we had sick leave for everybody? You know, what if we had income supports for those who need it? Not just as a function of this emergency, which is, you know, of course, very appropriate that we're doing it, and perhaps we need to do more, but as a routine thing, what would that mean for not only our ability to respond to future pandemics like this, but just for reduction of health inequalities and improvement of overall population health? We've also seen some very interesting aspects, you know, as a result of the social distancing, you know, traffic has gone down dramatically, and air pollution
we can see
has
that.
Gone down.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you can see that as well.
Exactly. And so I suspect traffic-related deaths are down, you know, precipitously. And it's probably true that many low-income people suffer from that, too. So you know, just the changes that we've been able to implement as a society in response to this emergency, what if we were able to make some of those changes just because we want to, because they're good for our society, because they're good for population health, because they're good for reducing health inequities and protecting the most vulnerable in our society.
Yeah. Dr. Wade, I'd love to have you weigh in on that and just add that last week we did a show where we looked at what countries in Europe are doing, and not all of them are doing the same things, but not surprisingly, a lot of the Scandinavian countries are, which have a very well-defined safety net, are essentially making sure that families don't fall underneath or below that safety net, and including keeping their incomes on a more stable basis. I guess in the best case scenario, what do you hope we learn and perhaps even implement out of this particular crisis?
Well, I think we learn what we already know. Martin Luther King said it best. He said, in a real sense, all life is interrelated. All men are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. And that's part of the positive thing that I've seen out of this. I think that people are starting to really value that social connection and the fact that how someone else fares impacts how I fare, and that we're all connected together and we need to support each other. I've seen, you know, as a parent, anecdotal examples of that within my own community about ways that families have come together at maintaining social distance policies to help their kids, you know, with their own development and growth. And, you know, I think that what this, you know, out of every crisis, you know, I think Dr. Kaufman said it, comes opportunity.
Yeah.
We saw that after World War II, and we see that after crisis, and this pandemic is no different. You know, from this, we will, you know, understand the importance of the social safety net and how such practices are mutually beneficial, not just beneficial for one specific population, but for us all.
Well, I do hope that we hold on to that that fact. We have just a couple of minutes, Dr. Rue, but even in the short term, looking ahead, what do we need to do perhaps that we're not doing, or what do we need to continue to do to kind of contain and control this pandemic?
Well, I think certainly we need to expand testing and do surveillance and studies to better characterize what's going on and the distribution across the population. And also, I think we also have to keep enhancing all the support mechanisms that we can offer, particularly low-income neighborhoods and communities of color, so that they are protected not just from the virus, but also from the other unintended consequences in terms of economics and social consequences that the social distancing has for these communities. I think that's really important and will have implications for their health after the pandemic is over.
Well, I thank you for the work that you were doing, and I thank you also for joining us today on Radio Times. Dr. Rue, Dr. Wade, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Ana Diaz-Rue, Dean and Distinguished University Professor of Epidemiology at Drexel University. Dr. Roy Wade is an Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania and a pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about the program. You can always download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.